Randy Isaac, the executive director for ASA. He has a bachelor's degree in physics from Wheaton College and a master's and PhD in physics from the University of Illinois. Very grateful to have him talk. He retired as a vice president at IBM in science and technology, an area dear to my heart. And we'll...
Thank you very much, Jim. And thank you, Walter, for an excellent introduction to the talk here. And I'd like to focus here on the uniqueness of DNA information. As you saw, DNA molecule is an excellent information storage device. And what we'd really like to see is there any evidence in the DNA information molecule and its work for intelligent agency? I will tell you my opinion right now, so you don't have to guess. So you can go hear another talk if you'd like. But really what I'd like to share is that in my opinion, after examining the differences between DNA information and other information systems, we really do not see that DNA information requires a conscious mind like other information systems do. Now let me explain what I mean, and we're going to do it in the following way. I'll take a few minutes to talk about what information is. Then we'd like to look under the covers. What is it about information systems that require an intelligent agent? Then what is unique about DNA information? That means, in my opinion at least, that it does not require an intelligent source, which doesn't mean there isn't an intelligent source. It just means, is there evidence for it, just looking from an information base? So first, let's start about what is information. And remember, I'm talking here from now a scientific perspective on the discipline of information theory. And in its simplest form, information is anything that could be different. That's where you have information. And James Gleick would tell us that this came from 1641 as the first indication of that, when John Wilkins, a vicar in England, said, "Whatever is capable of a competent difference perceptible to any sense may be a sufficient means whereby to express the cogitations." What does this all mean? Well, the simplest way is think of a coin. You toss a coin. Now, do you have information? As long as there is a competent difference perceptible to any sense, you have information. If the two sides of the coin are identical and no difference can be perceived, there's no information. That's probably the simplest way to think about it. So that means anytime you have a physical difference, two possibilities, then you have information. Another way to say it is information is the reduction of uncertainty. Since you had two possibilities, you had some uncertainty. What is the coin going to be? And once it lands, you can resolve, reduce the uncertainty. That was information. If there was no uncertainty, the two sides were the same. No uncertainty, no information. Now, that can be any discernible difference. Doesn't have to be heads or tails. Can be other things. Can be selection of the elements that you're using, the atoms that you're using. It can be a sequence. If you have several coins, you know, what's a heads, tails, heads. The sequence is a difference. Shape. We can see that in a lot of the biomolecules where shape is very important. Now, let's get one equation up here. We have to have something here. Claude Shannon, of course, is well known as putting information on the engineering roadmap here that you can do something with. Very simply, you can quantify information as being this equation where P sub I is the probability of a system being in one of n different possible states. Now, for a coin, there are two states, and the probabilities are equal if you don't have a loaded coin, and the equation simplifies to simply the log base 2 of n bits, and so it's very simple. You have one bit of information if you have two possible states. So this is just to show that there is some formalism and some discipline in terms of being able to quantify information. And Shannon is famous for concept of informational entropy, which shows how you can calculate and determine information, especially in a channel, in a noisy channel, and you can deal with that. And it really ushered in our current digital information age. Interestingly enough, for most of us who are not physicists or engineers, this kind of definition of information is totally uninteresting. Who cares? What we really want to know is functional information. What is useful? And many of you are familiar with the term of complex specified information. It does something functional. To me, functional information is kind of a little superset. It doesn't matter if it's complex or simple here. But anything that is useful, specified, meaningful, valuable, contextual, whatever, something that is useful. This is what we're really interested in. Here's the problem. Functional information cannot be quantified in the same way. You cannot deal with it as formally. Now, does it mean you can't do anything interesting with functional information? No. But it means you have to be a little careful. You cannot really apply the standard principles and maxims of information theory to functional information and its meaning. In fact, Claude Shannon says very explicitly, and I quote, "The meaning of information is of no interest to the engineer." And so what the meaning is not part of the information theory. So what do we do with that? Well, let's now think about information from another perspective. A few years ago, published a hierarchy of types of information, oversimplified to be sure, but it's supposed to clarify a few of the concepts. I like to call the base thermodynamics, because if you think about all possible physical states, it's virtually countless. From what we said, any physical difference can be discerned. If you get down to the atomic level and the spin states of electrons, it adds up. And there are estimates that in our whole universe, we have about 10 to the 150 bits of information. We only have 10 to the 80th elementary particles. So it's a really information-rich universe that we live in. But again, this is totally uninteresting to all of us. We can't do anything with it. And so to use information, we usually target a certain set of physical states. Now, this drawing is misleading because it looks almost the same, whereas it's more like 130 orders of magnitude smaller. But we decide we're going to deal with a certain set of information. Maybe you got a terabyte hard drive you want to deal with, or maybe we want to take a few coins, you know, get a few bits of information. We kind of decide we want to work with a targeted set of physical states. We're going to put together a syntax, which will say, all right, which of these in this terabyte hard drive, all these magnetic field domains, I don't need to work with all of them, but I'm going to organize them in a way, certain syntax that makes sense. And then finally, we have the semantics, and we'll talk a little bit about symbolism, and this is really the meaning. So information theory per se deals with the foundation here, the first few levels. And semantics and the meaning is outside of information. Now, the distinction is not quite as cut and dry and clear as this. There's a little fuzziness there. But the reason I bring this out is that it's important to remember when you're talking about functional and meaning of information, it's really not under the umbrella of information theory, even though you can use some principles of information theory to help us deal with that. Let me just give an example to hopefully make it a little clearer to you as to what we're talking about. The analogy here would be at the thermodynamic level would be all means of communication between humans or other species, all possible languages. A targeted set of physical states might be English. We're all agreed that at this conference we'll use English. There's a certain syntax in terms of how we will communicate it, and ultimately you have the meaning. So that's kind of the hierarchy that we're dealing with. Now, within that structure, let's now ask the question, why is it that some information systems require an intelligent agent? In other words, what we need to do is investigate where and why is there a relationship, and what is it, between information and intelligence. Let's go back to our structure here, and I would suggest that there are two main ways. There are others, but I think primarily we can think of two ways. First of all, intelligent agency is required here in the selection of your targeted physical states. As I said before, the universe has 10 of the 150 bits of information, maybe more, who knows. Information exists without intelligent agency. It is there, and you can get any asteroid that comes through the rock. It contains a lot of information, a lot of atoms in there. We can do something with that. That exists without any intelligent agency. However, once you start using information and you start dealing with it, typically what we do is we define a targeted physical kind of system. If we want to transmit information through a particular channel, we decide on that channel. Maybe it's an optical fiber, maybe it's a pair of copper wires. We decide on that system, we decide on the syntax, we agree on that. That all requires intelligent agent because we specifically pick systems that tend not to occur naturally. Because if we get naturally occurring states in there, that constitutes noise, and we have to deal with that. So that's a key place where intelligent agency is required. The other aspect is abstract meaning. And here I want to ask you to focus because there's a distinction here in my mind of symbolism here, of relationships of coded information that distinguishes between physical function, physical meaning, and abstract meaning. And I think you can really relate intelligent agents with abstract relationships. Okay, keep that in mind. It's an important kind of connection, and we'll keep looking at that. So these are the two main areas that I would suggest are places where information connects and requires intelligence. So what happens when we look at DNA information, and why is it different? The answer, in my opinion, is on this chart. The distinction is that from top to bottom in DNA, it's biochemical function with no abstract relationship. That is, we do not see any artificial information system that is designated. It's all described by a biochemical function. And the meaning I would suggest for your consideration is that the meaning is entirely implementation of a biochemical function. So you say, well, what does that mean? Let me first show you my conclusion slide again, just to make sure you know where I'm going and what I'm thinking. So I'm going to suggest that the meaning of DNA information is its biochemical function, which is dependent on its physical embodiment and environment. I'll come back to this phrase over and over a little bit, but it's dependent on its physical embodiment. In contrast, the meaning of information in human-designed information systems, virtually everything that we deal with, from language to mathematics to music to you name it, anything else, is really independent of its physical embodiment. In other words, zeros and ones can be anything. Can be magnetic field domains, it can be high voltage, low voltage, it can be photons, polarized photons, you name it. The meaning and the information is independent of that embodiment. Now, please don't misunderstand. Information is information is information. So DNA information is information in the same sense that an information system has information, but its meaning is different. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. So what I see in it, and I don't know if you will, you'll probably come to a different conclusion, but I don't see evidence that DNA information requires an intelligent agent for either its origin or its function. Let's look at that a little bit. For two examples, there are a lot of different aspects here that we could dig into, but with time being short, let's just look at two of them, one being the genetic code itself, and the other being some error correcting methods, which are two of many different ways in which there's a tendency to connect DNA information and intelligence. Now, what about the signature of the genetic code? What can we conclude from the existence of the genetic code? Does the existence of this code mean that there must have been an intelligent source? Now, Walter gave a fantastic lead into this in showing how the codons map to amino acids, so I can just get by with a very crude cartoon here. But he showed this in great detail, that in a cell you really have a lot of loaded tRNA with anticodons and amino acids, and with thanks to a ribosome you get a strand of messenger RNA whereby it's all coded and you get a string of amino acids together. So we can proceed to talk about this process, because it really is a code where the symbols are the codons, which is a collection of three nucleotides here, and each one of these then is the symbol for a particular amino acid. And the way this genetic tRNA looks, he showed you one version. This shows you another version of what it looks like. That tRNA is really 72, or actually 76 if you look at that acceptor stem, units that makes a unique relationship between an anticodon and an amino acid. So it turns out that for each possible anticodon, there is a unique amino acid, but not the reverse. Take a look at this particular description. There are many, many different ways in which you can express the genetic code. And in this particular one, the arrow doesn't show up too much over there, but I think you can see this. In this representation, codon is a set of three nucleotides, the first of which is represented, one of these four, and the second ring, you pick the second one, and the third nucleotide in the codon is in this ring, and you can see which amino acid results. Now, there are a few things I want to point out on this, and that is a very high degree of redundancy. You see that of the 64 possibilities of those codons, you see that really about 34 of them, the third codon is entirely a don't care. It's uniquely and totally specified by the first two nucleotides. That's an incredible amount of redundancy. And of the remaining 30, I think there are only two on here that are uniquely determined by only one codon. So there's an impressive degree of redundancy in all of these. You can also see that there's different polarities. Some are polar, some are nonpolar, some are basic, some are acidic. So there's different kind of relationships that here. So clearly it has a redundancy, and you can also see that it's not reversible. That you cannot determine uniquely what the codon sequence was from the amino acids. The information does not go in back. Now, it's kind of interesting to compare this DNA information code with a more human code. Now, many of you may have seen The Imitation Game, and it's fascinating. And here's a little picture of the Enigma code that the Nazis used. And this also is a physical implementation of a code. And this particular box then can be set with certain settings, and you can generate some kind of a code. The Nazis would change this code at midnight every night and send out their notes, and it had to be decoded rather quickly in order to intercept what was going on. So what we want to think through is, what are the differences and the similarities between these two different kinds of codes? One which And this one, which I think we recognize clearly, requires an intelligent agency to decode and encode. So why wouldn't the DNA information code, which is very similar, require the same? So what I say, how do we distinguish between natural versus intelligent agency in a code? And I would suggest two different aspects that we have to look at. One is the translation process, and the other is verification. First of all, is the code physical or abstract? I think if it's abstract, I think it's pretty clear you need that intellectual relationship. If you're going to say a code that says Q equals A, that's an abstract relationship. You can't derive it. On the other hand, you can make it mechanical. But if it's mechanical, was it really something designed like the Enigma box by an intelligent agent, or is it artificial? Well, if you can't tell, I mean, I think you'd tell the Enigma machine isn't likely to happen naturally, so you can kind of know that one, but it's not always obvious. And in a DNA molecule, it's really not so clear. Then I would say you go to verification. Okay. Can the code be verified physically or through an abstract relationship? Simple example, if I build a calculator that says 1 plus 1 equals 3, how do I verify that? Because mechanically it works perfectly. So if you don't know your math, yeah, it could be good. You need abstract relationship to verify it. Okay. Now, what do you do for the DNA code? Basically, what happens there is the verification is whether or not it's a life-sustaining function, whether or not the organism actually replicates. If it doesn't, it disappears forever. It can only sustain itself if it functions. It is a naturally occurring verification. So, does the existence of the genetic code mean there must have been an intelligent source? Well, I would say all the mapping is physical. The verification is physical reproduction. And you may say, yeah, but where did it come from in the first place? Didn't somebody have to set it up? Well, in the last 5 years, there's been some very intriguing hints of possible stereochemical origins. They've found that a few, not all, but a few basic codes actually have stereochemical affinities between the codon and the amino acid. That doesn't prove anything yet, but there's intriguing hints here of stereochemical origins, which were later mediated by tRNA molecules, which gave us more flexibility. So who knows? There's a lot to learn. Like Walter said, we don't know the origin of life. We don't know the origin of the genetic code. My point here is not that we know what it is, but I do not yet see a signature here that requires intelligent agency. Very quickly, what about error correction? Don't have time to go into it. I'll just show one DNA repair of homologous recombination. The main point I want to make is at the top, all error correcting processes that we see are of the nature where a physical or a chemical irregularity gets repaired. Okay. Like the one shown in the top line where there is a chemical fluctuation, something isn't right, and the cell detects it and fixes it. It's awesome. How in the world did that happen? Who knows? But to my knowledge, there is no error correction identified yet that takes a perfectly chemically balanced kind of system and says, you know, to get the right function, I need a C instead of a G, and replaces that. No error correction code does that, and since it senses only physical chemical abnormalities and no sequence correction is known, I would say we cannot detect the requirement for an intelligent agency there. Now, perhaps we'll find it yet. You know, I think it's an intriguing kind of piece, but in my opinion, at least, we have not yet seen any evidence of that DNA information requires an intelligent agent. In fact, the signature that we can see in the cell reproduction is one that looks very much like a clear biochemical function of natural reproduction. I think that God has created one incredible process, and we're just privileged to be able to worship our Creator in that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy. Any questions?
I have a quick question about, you were saying that the DNA code itself is physical and not
abstract.
DNA, the letters aren't physically dependent on the amino acid. So you could make artificial amino acids and code them for any codon you wish. Or, the amino acids are physical. If you have a lysine, it's always going to be that physical, it's going to have that physical effect in a liquid. But the DNA code itself is...
Yes. The question really is the relationship between the codon and the amino acid is not fixed. Indeed, and I should mention that there's not just one universal genetic code. By now, I think they've discovered, about 24, 25 different genetic codes. So it is not cast in concrete, not the only one. There is one primary one, and the differences are so small that you can really see how one morphed into the other, that it's evolved. They're all kind of related. So there is a relationship. But yes, indeed, we can artificially orchestrate different kind of relationships. That's perfectly okay. But it doesn't really alter the kind of question is that these can occur naturally. Yes, we can artificially, with intelligent agency, we can design others. It can happen. I'm not saying there's nothing involved there, and we can't do that, but we cannot make the jump to say that intelligent agency was required, and that's a little different statement. Was there, David?
About the estimate is that about 1.5% of the human genome codes for protein.
Yes.
The varying ideas about how much of the rest of it is coding or information about when to make it and so forth. Does the same structure apply to all of that other information?
Okay, the question was, since only about 1.5% of the genome codes for proteins, and that's all I've talked about, what about the rest of the DNA? Well, I think many of you know about the ENCODE project and the kind of interesting discussions down there, and certainly that's not in the process of making a protein, so it's not in the same kind of code. And what you find, an awful lot of comments have been made about the, quote, function, unquote, of the ENCODE. But if you look at that, it's a different kind of function. It's not the life-sustaining function in the direct way here. Much of the function, the ENCODE defined function in, five new different ways, one of which was simply transcription. He didn't really figure out what it was doing, and that's not 100% of it always. So there's a different structure there, and much of it, it's doing something, we're not really sure. A lot of it is epigenetic in its nature. So it's not the same, but again, I would offer the comment that I don't see anything in any of those processes that require an intelligent agency. I don't see that, but it's a little different argument from what I showed. We have one more? I thought it was one over there I wanted to take. Last one.
There's a group of researchers in San Pablo, Brazil, that have found evidence of Hamming codes inside DNA, which involve a form of redundancy, but it's a design redundancy.
Right.
Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I think Hamming codes, I think one of the intriguing things is I haven't spent much time here on the similarities, because there's a lot in the literature about similarities in terms of DNA code and what we do in our information systems. So I've kind of emphasized on the differences. But it's not clear to me why there's any concern here, but Hamming code is a way in which we describe the information there. Why should that require an intelligent agent on there? I don't see that connection.
Hamming codes are abstract. That's why.
The way we describe DNA is abstract. Okay, and I think it's important to differentiate how the DNA operates versus, what we impose on it. And I think that's a little bit tough. Time for one more quick one. What is it, Perry?
So if I have a PLC running code welding fenders on cars, and the meaning of the production line is code welds fenders on cars, is that physical or abstract?
Oh, it's got an awful lot of abstract stuff connected with it. Yeah, like I said before at the beginning, where is intelligent agency required? You've got a whole lot of structure that requires it over there.
But we know that because we designed it.
Precisely.
If you found it and there was no people attached to it, could you reasonably assume that there was abstract thought involved or not?
And that's why I put out the notion, you have to look at the translation, you have to look at the verification, you have to look to see where something is. So we'll keep talking about
this. Let's thank Randy one more time. My